Expanding the circle of compassion to include all living beings.
First of all, the world is a finite place. And secondly, the things that we do now have implications for the way the world will be. The amount of natural resources available, the amount of fresh water available, the options and opportunities in so many ways for the people who will come next. So we simply have to expand this circle of compassion.
That's Carl Safina. We'll spend the hour talking with him about his powerful and moving book, The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. And literary critic Harold Bloom. We talked to him last year about his wonderful collection of last poems, Till I End My Song. He calls it a defense of poetry. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When I first heard about the book The View from Lazy Point, I said, hey, I know that place. Lazy Point is a flat peninsula of scrubby pines, to quote the author, between Long Island Sound and the Peak Bay in Amagansett, Long Island. It's about 5 miles from where I live. I biked out there this past summer, passing salt marsh, those scrubby pines, and an old, defunct fish factory. It's where marine ecologist, writer, and MacArthur fellow Carl Safina lives, and it's his vantage point on the world's oceans. Oceans that are in deep trouble from multiple assaults. In The View from Lazy Point, Safina alternates between two poles. One is lyrical descriptions of the beauty of place, bringing to the mind's eye a tender observation of terns, sea ducks, and other shorebirds, as well as bluefish and horseshoe crabs. The other is strong warnings about the impact of climate change and environmental abuse. Safina also travels to other places on our watery planet to show us some inspiring success stories, along with some failures. One reviewer said, emphasizing the fact that where nature is most abused, so too are human rights, Safina argues that we must renew the social contract, free ourselves from the politics of greed, and embrace the facts about the still thriving, yet endangered, immeasurably precious living world. Carl Safina, welcome to Writer's Voice. You have a wonderful quote by E.B. White starting the book. I arise in the morning torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to savor the world. And that seems very much to inform the way you've written the book. You alternate between writing about the grave dangers, the threats that face our world, as well as celebrating the beauty that still remains.
Yes, I've known about that quote for a long time, and I was a little reluctant to actually use it because it sums up my life a little too closely. But it's true, and it's one of the main motivations I had for writing the book, is that if you are in the environmental world, as I am, it seems like all you ever get is a lot of gloom and doom and a lot of terrible news. But if you're a naturalist and you look around and you just think about trends, you realize that, first of all, the world is still absolutely a beautiful place. And secondly, there are really dangerous trends, but there's a lot to inform us about other dangerous trends that we have lived through. Times have been very bad before. The future is not really knowable. And so I really reject the idea of just throwing up our hands and say the world is over, because we really don't know. But I do think that the trends now are very dangerous. There is a lot at stake, and I think everybody really should not hide from that either.
You say that, it's possible to see the whole world in the view from Lazy Point. What are some of the changes that you've seen there that kind of bring this home to you?
Well, I think if you have your eyes open, you can see the whole world from anywhere. But what I've seen out at Lazy Point and in my life around Long Island, because I grew up around Long Island, and I have some perspective. It's just as far as nature itself, there's less of it. Some of the bird populations are down a lot. Many of the fish populations are down a lot. But if you also look, you see some fish populations are up because of things that people have done. Some birds are back, especially the ones that were the most vulnerable, like ospreys and peregrine falcons that were just about wiped off the face of the earth by DDT and the other hard pesticides. Those returned after those pesticides were banned. So there's a tremendous resilience that you can see at work as well. And that is a tremendous reservoir of hope, because if we recognize what we're doing and back off or do the right things or change our course, then I think that we can recover a lot of these things that we are losing.
In fact, you have some stories in the book of places where things are still being lost, like corals, which I'll ask you a little bit more about, and also places where they are coming back. But the overriding concern I feel, and that I also get from your book, is climate change. And it seems like that's something that is so great and so overwhelming. How do we step back from that?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that the structure of the book is it's a calendar year, and it's set here at home at Lazy Point where I live. But over the course of the year, we travel to the high Arctic, to Antarctica, and across about half of the tropical seas of the world. So it's very, very local and very personal, but it's also very global and very big picture. And yeah, in many of the travels, a lot of the problems, although not certainly not all, but a lot of the problems have something to do with changing climate, warming oceans, warming air, melting ice, oceans getting more acidic because of the same carbon dioxide that's warming the air and the water is also changing the pH of the water. And that would be happening even if it didn't have a warming effect. So there are these enormous problems. The underwriting problem of all of them is that there are just incredible numbers of us on the planet and increasing constantly. By the middle of this century, it is predicted at the rate we're going that we will add about 2 billion more people. That's China times two added to what we have now, and everybody wants to live better. So the idea that we can grow our way out of these problems seems to me irrational. I think we could shrink our way out of these problems, because if everybody wants more and the pie is the same size pie, the Earth itself doesn't grow. The planetary system does not grow. Then to give everybody more, you could do that if you had fewer people sharing the pie.
Yeah, you actually make a distinction between growth and development. Could you detail that a bit?
I think it's an important distinction. Growth means making something bigger. And that the only way you can do that is to put more material through it or into it. But you could develop, which means to make things better, without necessarily growing. You know, some things can be better by making them smaller and scaling them down and scaling them back so that the people who are around have individually have more. And I'm certainly not, you know, to me, this is a very pro-person and pro-life thing, actually. It's not anti-people. I think that the biggest anti-people thing, I think, is to just say that more and more and more will be better, because that's a fantasy. And what it results in is more poverty, more hunger, more tension, less peace. But the best way, I don't advocate coercive or certainly violent or apocalyptic ways of reducing population. I do know people who think we don't have to worry about it. There'll be mass wars, there'll be horrible plagues, and it'll take care of itself. I mean, to me, that's a total catastrophe, not a solution. But simply teaching girls to read and write turns out to be the best thing that you can do to more quickly drastically lower the birth rates, because that's the way it works. People have richer, more interesting lives, and they understand how to plan their families and have what they want instead of just what happens to them or what gets forced on them. And the children of literate women also tend to be literate and have more opportunity in life and less poverty and more control over their lives. So to me, that is an absolute winning way out of this thicket.
That's an example of the way that I feel that you write this book. You write as an ecologist. You make the connections between climate, but natural systems and human systems. And you have a wonderful phrase in the book. You say, the geometry of human progress is expanding the circle of compassion. That really struck me, and I wonder if you could say more about that.
Sure. If you simply look at what counts as the advances in the world, the social advances in the world, it mainly has to do with including people, including groups of people who were left out previously. So in ancient Greece, the only people who could be citizens were property-holding men. And that, of course, I mean, look, you know, if you just fast forward to our country, it's not just property-holding men who were all white. It's also the people who were formerly the slaves. It's women. Women can now go to school and get an education. I mean, the more you allow people to, the more opportunity you allow to people and the less you exclude them, the more we see that as progress. Although every single step of that way, every rights movement, every liberation movement, every attempt to for people to claim their human rights or to force their way into society has been marked by violence and bloodshed. But when you look back on it, you say, well, of course, it was obviously the absolute right thing that we needed to do. And every time people have tried to separate people, the extreme there is Nazi Germany, saying that these people are really humans and these people are subhumans and these people can't be property holders any longer. I mean, this is a hideous, hideous perversion when you look back on it, even though to some people at the time, I guess it must have seemed like a good idea. When you're in the middle of it, it's not always clear what is right. But if you simply have the benefit of hindsight, you see that including people in this expanding circle of compassion is always the right thing to do.
We're talking with Carl Safina. His wonderful new book is The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World.
Well, there are probably no places that are not in some peril, but there are success stories around in various ways. In the case of the coral reefs that I visited in Palau in Micronesia, the success there is that they had the wisdom, also partly because their population was low enough, they were able to do this, but they had the wisdom to prevent the export of fish from their reefs. And most people think that reef fish rely on coral reefs for their living, which is true. But another part that is also true is that the reefs rely on the fish themselves to stay alive. That the fish are constantly grazing the algae that's always trying to overgrow all the coral. And if you fish the fish down too low, the algae gets out of control. Once that happens, the coral dies and cannot reestablish itself. And it just goes from a coral reef to a rubble field full of seaweed, a very, very different thing that is a lot less productive.
Yeah, and here was a place where the reefs had actually died about 10 years ago because of climate change, but they were able to bring them back. Give us the ecology of this recovery.
Well, in Palau, about 10 years ago, there was a tremendous heat spike, as there was around many of the tropical places in the world, and a lot of coral died, and a lot of coral died permanently. But in Palau, it died temporarily and was able to come back. And the reason was that the reefs are swarming with these fish that they don't allow to be exported. And the fish continued to just keep the algae grazed so low, you can't even see it. Scientists have watched how many times fish come by and just bite at each square meter of the reef, each square yard of the reef, and it's like 100 bites an hour in a lot of places. So they're scraping off these little micro layers of algae that are barely getting a foothold. People can't even see the algae. And that's why those reefs were able to reestablish, because they had their fish. And as I said, it's not just that the fish rely on the corals rely on the fish as well.
So it seemed to me that, you know, is there a larger lesson here? I mean, even as we face these potentially catastrophic changes to our planet, there are yet things that we can do to nurture the recovery of life.
One of the larger lessons is that the root causes of a lot of our trouble, which people never seem to really focus on, have to do with environmental problems. In Egypt, for instance, the price of food is rising really, really rapidly. Part of that reason is crop failure due to altered rain in really large areas of the world. And a lot of that altered rain has to do with climates that are changing and shifting as a result of, you know, the overall warming of the planet. In Rwanda, the genocide between two groups that never really liked each other was sparked into incredible violence, partly, well, actually largely, because they were simply running out of farmland. And one of the groups thought if they could simply kill all of the members of the other group, they would be able to have the farmland. So many of these things that look ideological or ethnic, yes, there are conflicting ideologies and ethnicities that are on the outs, but they tend to live uneasily side by side until some underlying environmental problem pushes them into violent conflict. In Darfur, a lot of it had to do with conflict between the nomadic pastoralists and their goats mainly, and farmers who were in one place growing crops. The herders came into the farming areas because there was nothing for their herds to graze because the rains had failed for so long. So a lot of these things that we think, oh, it's just people fighting over ideology, or oh, it's just ethnic groups, it's not just those things. It's those things plus nature being pushed past the point where it can support people because it's being asked to support more people than it can support.
Another blind spot that you talk about is temporal, how we discount the future. You say we need, that we're really working with the old wisdoms, the old philosophies that were born during a time when the world was quite different, where there was plenty of room, plenty of resources. What's the new philosophy we need, and how do we need to think in terms of time?
Well, first of all, the old philosophies, which we still run our lives by, and what I mean by the old philosophies, including institutions like our economy, our capitalist economy, is not new. It's many centuries old. It was fully written down the way we use it now in the 1300s, where our way of accounting that says that the main, with banks and with stock markets and with all the things we think of as parts of the modern economy and capitalism, was written down with the idea that the main assets of banks are other people's debts. So banks get wealthier the deeper other people go into debt. And we see where that got us. That is the story of the last recession. So we haven't really learned. We did learn for close to 100 years, but we took all of those safeguards off because we've been in a very anti-regulatory mood. Well, I shouldn't say we. I should say greedy people have. And their greed has really overwhelmed and almost wrecked the entire world economy and is causing incredible pain to a lot of people in the aftermath of all of that chaos. Our religions are centuries old or thousands of years old. Our philosophies by which Westerners declared their relationship with nature is actually thousands of years old. We still live a lot by some of the Greek philosophy and some of the ancient and medieval philosophy that says that nature is here for us instead of it being a two-way street, or instead of saying that, you know, we are here because nature supports us, which is the truth of the matter. And if you think of many of the really most fundamental things that we do nowadays, we've been doing since we lived in caves. For instance, when we manufacture things, we keep what we want, the thing we made, and everything that we don't want, we just leave and throw away. So we've been doing that since we've been chipping stone tools. We just kept the tool and left the chippings. And when we were stripping the meat off of bones, we left the bones. That is still the way the economy works. In fact, economists will tell you that all the waste of manufacturing is what they call, quote, external, unquote, to the market, which simply means that the economy doesn't price or value the waste products, because it used to be a very big world and the waste was totally organic or degradable, so it wasn't ever a problem. But now it's an enormous problem. First of all, when you throw stuff out, it goes to other people downstream somewhere. And we have in the last, I would say, certainly century, really only about 60 years, our waste includes things that are toxic and don't break down for thousands of years or hundreds of years and come back around to people and build up and get more and more concentrated in the environment. That's really new. And our economy has no way of dealing with that and has declared that anything we don't want, we don't have to pay for. But we do pay for it greatly. For instance, the price of coal is considered to be really cheap. And one way that people argue we cannot get to the new energy that we would really need to run the future of the world is that right now coal is still so cheap. So if I buy a ton of coal, I pay for a ton of coal. But what I don't pay for is all the other things that coal actually costs. Blowing the tops off of mountains, all of the acid drainage that kills streams that don't get buried while they blow the tops off mountains, the health and safety of all the workers and health problems in all of those communities.
The asthma that affects so many people.
Well, the asthma and the contaminants and all these new problems are part of those things that economists insist are external and don't have to be in the price of things. So there's that. There's all the mercury that is coming into all the new mercury that comes into seafood comes from burning coal. The heat balance of the whole planet is altered because we're burning coal. And the pH of the oceans is declining, meaning it's becoming more acidic, which is already starting to kill larval oysters and shellfish in commercial growing operations, especially on the West Coast. It's slowing the growth of corals. I mean, coal is by far the most costly thing we have ever lit a match to, and yet we're told that we can't stop using it because it's cheap. That is a market failure on a scale that the world has actually probably never known. It's such a total disconnect with the reality of it, and the economy doesn't, it has no sensory apparatus because it has decided, since we lived in caves, actually, it decided that we'll just keep what we want and we'll throw the rest away. But throwing it away now is creating enormous problems for other people.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, I'm talking with author, ecologist, and MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, Carl Safina, about his book, The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World.
Yeah, you talk about, you know, what right do we have not only to rob other people who are living right now, but to kind of eat the lunch, as you say, of succeeding generations. I mean, people talk about their children and grandchildren. I think of what right do we have to rob the generations that are far in the future? What kind of planet will they have?
I think that We're really, really limiting and narrowing the options for just the next generation. We don't even have to think about, well, what about 10 generations from now? It's not that remote. I'm sure that we are not alone in thinking that the people who are now the younger generation coming up face a much stiffer time than we did. And that's because we've narrowed the options from them. And this is the first generation in the United States, where people don't think that their children have a wider array of opportunities and are likely to be more successful and have an easier time than they did. And that's because of we're eating through all the capital.
Yeah, so we need a new philosophy.
Yes, well, we do. I think that if we took what we learned about the world in just the last 150 years, well after all of our institutions that we actually do business by were set, we would come up with a very different philosophy and a different religion and a different economy than we have now. It's only in the last 200, let's say, really a lot less, significantly less than 200 years, but let's just say in under 200 years, we've learned for the first time that the world actually changes. People had no sense, there was no geology before about the 1820s, 1820s to 40s, let's say, was when people started to realize the world wasn't always the way we see it out the front door. It seems to have once been much different. The word dinosaur was coined in, I think, the 1830s, as was the word scientist. People had no idea in the mid-1800s that there were things that we now think of as germs, bacteria, and viruses that make people sick. We had no idea that all living things are related by ancestry. We had no idea about genetics. We didn't know that DNA was the coding mechanism in our cells for how cells and organisms build themselves. We didn't know anything when we erected these institutions by which we still run all our daily business. So the way we do business reflects the way we understood the world when we didn't understand the world at all. And it really shows.
So now that we do understand the world better, what is the philosophy that needs to catch up with our greater understanding or scientific understanding of the world?
Okay, well, first of all, the world is a finite place. And secondly, the things that we do now have implications for the way the world will be. The amount of natural resources available, the amount of fresh water available, the options and opportunities in so many ways for the people who will come next. So we simply have to expand this circle of compassion to realize that all the things that we are wasting and throwing away have they're not gone. There's no way to throw them to, either physically or in time. Either other people will suffer or we will collectively pay with our security and stability, or our children and the next generations will have to pay the bill. The other thing we still do, like we've done since we lived in caves, is every time we want some energy to do some work, we light it on fire. We light something on fire. We've been doing this since we lived in caves. And yet the world is run by non-combusting energy. It's sunlight, the energy of the tides, the heat of the earth, the wind. These are the eternal sources of energy that actually run the planet. So I think we need to come out of the Middle Ages and out of ancient times and out of the caves and come up with a way of doing business and an economy that includes all of the costs, so that if that was the case, for instance, coal would be prohibitively expensive and renewable energy would be the no-brainer of energy competition.
It would be subsidized.
Well, and right now it would probably have to be subsidized. Well, the problem right now on the open market is that there is no open market, that fossil fuels are heavily subsidized and the rest of them have to eat the crumbs of minor little subsidies or just try to compete, which is why a lot of them are running to Europe and to China. We seem to have given China our entire economy and our future just so we could have a bunch of cheap stuff and wreck our labor unions, which created the American dream and the mobile middle class. I don't think that we are getting the best of that trade at all. I think it's terrifying, and especially because China is a communist country that is authoritarian, and it's not a democracy. We've given them our manufacturing. We've given them all our jobs. We have allowed them to hold a gigantic debt over our heads, and now we're giving them the opportunity to develop the energy future. Mm-hmm. That whoever develops the energy future will own the future, and they'll sell it back to the rest of the world. So we'll have to buy that from them while we pay them our debt burden as well.
Carl Safina. We'll talk more about his book, The View from Lazy Point, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with marine ecologist and writer Carl Safina about his book, The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. It's about the dangers that threaten this still beautiful planet of ours and what we must do to save it. One critical threat is overfishing. We talked a little bit before about how the coral reefs were depending on fish to actually keep them alive, to keep them healthy. And places where coral reefs have been overfished are places where coral reefs are dying. There are issues about overfishing right here. And in fact, I was just reading the local paper, the excellent local paper, the East Hampton Star, yesterday, where there was an article right on the front page about, fishermen being up in arms against a certain kind of a way of trying to control the numbers of fish that are being caught here. You know, they're saying that this is destroying us. You give the example of an old fish factory, which is now no longer in existence. Talk a little bit about, the pressures that fishermen are facing. What's the situation? What's the solution for a place like Lazy Point, for a place like the east end of Long Island?
Well, I think there are two important things to keep in mind. One is that a lot of the fish now are really greatly diminished from what they were and really depleted by overfishing. But some of them are much more abundant now than they were 20 years ago. And that depends entirely on the actions and restrictions that that people have taken that fishermen are faced with. The demand for fish simply overwhelms completely the ability of the fish to reproduce. And so without restraint and without these kinds of regulations, we do run out of fish. This is the story of the entire world. It's our local story as well. And we see that the few species that have come back because of restrictions. Once they are back, they support much more economic activity than they can support when they are at extremely low levels. So it's really worth getting them back and then continuing to operate in a way that, is restrained.
And yet the fishermen are saying they can't live with those restrictions. Is there some what is to be done here? You know, here right now it's an adversarial position. I think that the efforts of the EPA to put some restrictions or actually of NOAA. Of NOAA. What
is NOAA again? NOAA is the National Oceanic and National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's really a sub-agency called the National Marine Fisheries Service that does the regulations. But fishermen who say that they can't live with the regulations also can't live without the regulations. Many fishermen have gone out of business. I mean, by the thousands around the country and around the world, because they have depleted the fish that they once relied on, but they also used to catch those fish faster than they can reproduce. And they have really just absolutely demolished gigantic populations of fish in the ocean. We are capable of doing that.
Mm-hmm. So Then you bring up the example of the horseshoe crab. I have been coming out to this area now where I'm living here on the east end of Long Island for many, many years. I remember horseshoe crabs being, you know, plentiful upon the beaches. And now, you know, I think I've found one in the last 10 months that I've been here. That was really shocking to me. What's happened to the horseshoe crabs?
The horseshoe crabs used to be used for bait for whelks and eels, and now there are incredible markets overseas for those things, so there's really no end to the appetite for them. And without any restrictions on the amount of horseshoe crabs that can be caught, the horseshoe crabs declined because fishermen just took thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of them from around Long Island to use for bait. And many people may think that that has nothing to do with them, but it also happens, coincidentally, that horseshoe crab blood is required for a test that is used for every batch of intravenous and injectable drug to see if that batch is contaminated with bacteria. So there are laboratories that catch horseshoe crabs, take some of their blood, and release them alive. This is something that is critical for the health of every American. And yet we also let fishermen take them by the hundreds for bait at a rate that really reduces the population. Now, recent restrictions, which of course the fishermen didn't like, has started to stabilize that. And in some of the other states, the restrictions vary from state to state. In some of the other states, the horseshoe crab population has actually started to inch up a little bit in the last few years because of very drastic restrictions in response to very drastic increase in the amount of horseshoe crabs that fishermen were taking. And why are they taking horseshoe crabs to catch eels and whelks? Partly because the other fish that were once incredibly plentiful are also scarce, and everybody is scrambling and scraping the bottom of the barrel. Now, I live within a mile of the ruins of two fish factories, one of which had a set of railroad tracks going to it. It used to produce such volume. And those things ended as a result of their own too much, their own overdoing it. In an era before the first restriction on any kind of fishing ever went into effect, they demolished their own resource base and put themselves completely out of business. So what conservation is about is trying to prevent those things from being the story of everything and to move from a period where everybody is interested only in how much can I take to a period of how much do we need to leave and how do we get back some of what was taken from us by the excessiveness of what's gone before, just as we need to prevent ourselves from indulging in the excessiveness which will rob our children blind.
Yeah, you tell a very dramatic story about the horseshoe crab in your book, Carl Safina, in The View from Lazy Point, where you confront a fisherman. I mean, here you come out. Tell us the story. You know, you came out on a very important day for the horseshoe crab.
I was taking a walk in the moonlight along the shore, and I just happened to, it was a full moon. That's one of the reasons that I was out walking. And I just happened onto the spawning of the horseshoe crabs. I was new to the place, so I didn't realize that they spawned along that shore. And what they do in May and June in the full moons, they come up and lay their eggs at the highest reach of the highest tides. And then the next full moon stimulates the eggs to hatch, and the little tiny hatchlings go into the water. So I was enchanted by the scene of all these horseshoe crabs coming up and mating and digging nests and laying eggs in the moonlight. And I called my partner, Patricia. She came out, and we were delighting in the whole scene. And then a pair of headlights came bouncing up the beach, and it was a pickup truck with a fisherman, and we could suddenly hear the thudding of many horseshoe crabs going into the truck. It's the ones with the eggs that are the best bait. So he was trying to take every female who was there to lay eggs and throw them in the truck. Now, I don't have as much of an appetite for direct confrontation, but Pat simply decided that if he was going to take the horseshoe crabs off the beach, she was going to take the Horseshoe crabs off the beach too, but throw them into deep water where he couldn't reach them. And when he realized that she was doing that directly to oppose what his plans were, we had, he and I had a confrontation. She stayed in the water throwing Horseshoe crabs into deep water at as fast and furious a pace as she could, because she was really wound into quite an anger about the whole thing. And he was making his case to me that it was all legal. And I said, yes, I know it's legal. And he said, and we have a limit, 500 a night. And I looked at, I said, 500 a night? There's not 500 crabs here on the whole beach right now. You just can't do that with a hope of continuing to do it. He said, well, my grandfather used to do it. Well, your grandfather used to take a few for bait. He wasn't shipping them out of state for a dollar a piece like you can do now, because the whole market has changed and the demand has so thoroughly changed. So, you know, we didn't come to blows or anything like that. He was upset. I was upset. She was upset. Then another truck came by, and I thought, well, this really changes the balance of the whole conversation. But they conferred, and they decided to simply leave. And we left, of course, after a while. We came back in the morning. There were lots of tracks all over the beach. They obviously had come back. And when I went back the next month, instead of finding hundreds, I found six.
Horseshoe crabs.
Six horseshoe crabs, yeah.
Oh, God, this is such a terrible story. So then you went to Southeast Alaska. That's another place. Tell us about that. Why did you go there?
I went to Southeast Alaska originally, not for this book exactly, but for another book that a photographer was putting together, and she asked me to go and write about one little piece of what was happening there. And she wanted me to write about how the salmon come up the streams and bring nutrients that wind up actually growing the trees. Now, people don't really quite think of it that way, but think of it this way. The salmon are born in the streams, and they leave as quite little fish. When they return, they're much bigger fish. And what that really is that they have gathered all the nutrients of the ocean as their bodies. Their bodies are what a salmon is. It's all the nutrients of the deep ocean fighting its way against gravity up into the streams in these forests. And it's not a coincidence that the forests of the Pacific Northwest, in which some of the trees are thousands of years old, and many of them are centuries old, so they predate any fishing or any settlement by white people. It's no coincidence that those forests grow more wood per acre than any forest in the world, including the Amazon and all the tropical forests that you think of as these great rainforests. But the rainforests of the temperate rainforests of the Pacific Northwest are the most productive, heaviest forests in the world. And it's not a coincidence. The difference is they have salmon to fertilize the forests. The bears come out, the eagles come out, the mink and otters come out. All these things drag salmon into the forest. A lot of it is eaten, a lot of it is not eaten. Even what's eaten eventually gets recycled into the forest. And so it's the ocean coming inland by itself in the form of salmon that grows these incredible trees. So that's the story that I went there first to write about. But I wound up just absolutely falling in love with the place, because it's a fantastic, fantastic wilderness, absolutely full of fish, bears, whales, eagles. It's just incredible. A lot of it is better now than it was 50 years ago, because people learned that they were overdoing it with the fish, they were overdoing it with the logging. So we're through some of the worst problems there, and it's better now. We learned lessons, we implemented changes, and it improved because nature has resilience. And it's not a place that you have to go backpacking for months to get into. We were puttering around in a beautiful modern boat. There were fishing boats there doing commercial fishing. There were modern people living in and around this incredible wilderness full of wildlife and fantastic forests. And the difference was it just wasn't overrun with people. It was enough. It just wasn't too much. And that made the difference. And that, I thought, was a real vision for the success of the whole future of the world.
And, you know, Carl, Safina, I also want to say that this book, The View from Lazy Point, not only talks about all the things that we've been discussing here, but is also written with great beauty and poetry. I think you do it very, very successfully. A lot of nature writers do write with a lot of poetry in their writing, but yours is very spare. The turn of the phrase is just marvelous. I'd like to ask you, would you be willing to read from your prelude of the book? That would be great.
I'm really gratified that you're talking about the writing itself, because one thing I've always been is a synthesist, and there are plenty of people who write about nature, and there are plenty of people who write about environmental issues, and not a lot of people put those things together in a way that makes it very enjoyable to read. So that's the task that I set out for myself. And in almost all the interviews about pretty much any book, I mean, just to make sure that I wasn't filtering this personally, I've watched other authors on these book shows, and I've listened to other authors talk and be interviewed. And almost all interviews with authors are about the issues that they write about. And very few of them, even for authors for whom the craft of writing is really, really a big deal in their book, they're still interviewed about the subjects that they've written about. And I've tried really to write a book that would make people very much enjoy the act of reading and the experience of reading. So I thank you for mentioning the actual way it's written.
Yeah, and so if you could read the whole prelude is wonderful, but I think maybe we just have time for the first page.
Yeah. Okay, so the very, very beginning of the book, what you would think of as the preface, is called the prelude in this book, and here's some of it. I slide a fishing rod into my kayak as birds begin gathering over our bay. They know what's coming, and so do I. On many summer afternoons, packs of surfacing bluefish chase up small fish, drawing excited flocks of diving terns. As it has been for millennia, so it is this very moment. Contrary to all the gloom in the news, the future is by no means doomed. I'm continually struck by how much beauty and vitality the world still holds. But beauty and vitality isn't the whole story either. In the panic among the fishes and in the frenzying terns, it's also evident that nature has neither sentiment nor mercy. What it does have is life, truth, and logic, and it strives for what it cannot have, an end to danger, an assurance of longevity, a moment's peace, and a comfortable death. It's like us all, because we are natural. What anyone needs to know about mercy, one can learn from watching nature strive, seeing people struggle, and realizing what a compassionate mind could add to the picture. So I'm also struck that we who have named ourselves wise humans, Homo sapiens, haven't quite realized that nature, civilization, peace, and human dignity are all facets of the same gemstone, and that abrasion of one tarnishes the whole.
The book is The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. Thanks so much, Carl Safina, for talking with us here.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I visited literary critic and octogenarian Harold Bloom in his New Haven home to record an interview about his book, Till I End My Song. It's a marvelous collection of poems along with Bloom's commentary. All the poems are what Bloom calls last poems, written in the face of our inevitable mortality.
By last poems, I sometimes mean in this volume, perhaps more often than not, the very last poem that they wrote, like Michael Drayton's beautiful poem to the lady he had loved, but only in a companionate or friendly fashion all his life. In his last poem, the poem written the night before he dies, or a poem that seems to operate like a last poem. The Tempest is not Shakespeare's last play, but Prospero's extraordinary climactic speech, pragmatically, is something close to Shakespeare's last poem. Or finally, a poem that a particular poet saw as the climax or fulfillment of their poetic career in relation to the inevitability of an impending death. So those are three different senses, but they are related. A literal last poem, intended as a last poem, I would take, as I've mentioned already, Michael Drayton, a good friend of Shakespeare, the lovely poem beginning so well, I love thee. I write a brief commentary to introduce each of these poems, and he himself writes, I won't read the whole poem because it is 21 lines, and he writes, these verses were made by Michael Drayton Esquire, poet laureate, the night before he died, and it opens beautifully. It's addressed to this lady he had been brought up with, Anne Goodair, Lady Rainsford. He had been a page in the service of Sir Henry Goodair, a friend of Sir Philip Sidney. Goodair's daughter Anne and Drayton, as I write, were childhood friends, but their mutual love was socially impossible, since he was a commoner and she was a high noblewoman, and they sanely settled for a perpetual friendship. And he commemorates that, since she's going to survive him. And he's very ill, and he knows he's dying, and so beautifully written, so well I love thee, as without thee I love nothing. If I might choose, I'd rather die than be one day debarred thy company. Since beasts and plants do grow and live and move, beasts are those men that such a life approve. He only lives that deadly is in love, meaning that is certainly and fully in love. And then he ends the poem very beautifully. So all my thoughts are pieces but of you, which put together makes a glass so true, as I therein no other's face but yours can view. I find that quite exquisite and a beautiful tribute to the lady and a wonderful dying word on his part. Then I thought, since there are 56 poets, more or less, of the modern period from Thomas Hardy to the present, of them, about 25 were people I knew personally, 7 or 8 of them very close friends indeed. One of them was certainly a wonderful poet and wonderful human being, wonderful novelist also, Robert Penn Warren. And I want to find his poem, Heart of Autumn. I once told him that if I had to choose a single poem by him as his last poem, in the sense that it speaks his total word with permanent distinction, I would choose Heart of Autumn. And it's an extraordinary poem. I can't bear not to read all of it or chant all of it. Read, I think, must have been in his 70s, when he wrote this poem. Heart of Autumn. Wind finds the northwest gap. Fall comes. Today, under gray cloud scud and over gray wind flicker of forest in perfect formation, wild geese head for a land of warm water, the boom, the lead pellets. Some crumple in air, fall. Some stagger, recover control. Then take the last glide for a far glint of water. None know what has happened. Now today, watching how tirelessly V upon V arrows the season's logic, do I know my own story? At least they know when the hour comes for the great wing beat. Sky strider, star strider, they rise, and the imperial utterance which cries out for distance quivers in the wheeling sky. That much they know, and in their nature know the path of pathlessness, with all the joy of destiny fulfilling its own name. I have known time and distance, but not why I am here. Path of logic, path of folly, all the same. And I stand, my face lifted now skyward, hearing the high beat, my arms outstretched in the tingling process of transformation, and soon tough legs with folded feet trail in the sounding vacuum of passage, and my heart is impacted with a fierce impulse to unwordable utterance toward sunset at a great height. I find that marvelous. I find that Red Warren really assimilating himself to those wild geese and to their flight, which becomes an image of both the limitations and the strength of his own poetic imagination. And then within the third sense, the sense of a last poem really as a way of coming to terms with all of life, and a very close friend, A.R. Ammons, Archie Ammons, who died in 2001 when he was 75, remarkable poet. He wrote a poem in 1996, 5 years before his death, and it seems to me truly his last poem, as I say here, because it's miraculous in its control of a universal poignance. I won't read all of it aloud, but I want to read the very opening and the close. It's called In View of the Fact. The people of my time are passing away. My wife is baking for a funeral, a 60-year-old who died suddenly, when the phone rings, and it's Ruth we care so much about in intensive care. It was once weddings that came so thick and fast, and then first babies, such a hullabaloo. Now it's this, that, and the other, and somebody else gone or on the brink. Well, we never thought we would live forever, although we did, and now it looks like we won't. And then he goes on talking about how these things work out for us. And he suddenly says very powerfully, at the same time we are getting used to so many leaving, we are hanging on with a grip to the ones left. We are not giving up on the congestive heart failures or brain tumors, on the nice old men left in empty houses, or on the widows who decide to travel a lot. We think the sun may shine someday when we'll drink wine together and think of what used to be. Until we die, we will remember every single thing, recall every word, love every loss. Then we will, as we must, leave it to others to love. Love that can grow brighter and deeper to the very end, gaining strength and getting more precious all the way. I find that, of course, almost unbearably moving because I have been missing him now for 9 years. But, you know, I'm making this anthology sound too somber, and I don't think it is somber. I think it is affirmative. I think, as Wallace Stevens greatly remarked, poetry is one of the enlargements of life.
Harold Bloom. His wonderful collection of last poems, as he calls them, is Till I End My Song. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests and see videos or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.